This is Fully Vested, a weekly podcast where Jason Rowley and Graham Peck discuss technology and venture capital investing. This week, we explore several funding rounds that have been announced since the COVID-19 pandemic. This is another in our series of good news during the pandemic episodes. Those companies are immigrant-founded, Chicago-based CashDrop, a small retail POS, Trove, a Y Combinator S20 class graduate in the option pool management business, Barn to Door, a Shopify for farm to table, and Undock, a new way to manage your schedule. This show was recorded on September 1st. You can learn more at fullyvested.co.
So Graham, do you know what I don't have to deal with anymore?
What's that?
You know how, like, when we would record this show and there would be the sound of, like, the L train going down or going around, like, the corner around Lake and Wales?
I'm going to miss that, which I assume our listeners never hear, but I could tell when it was happening.
Oh, no. I mean, it showed up in some of the recordings, but it's no longer going to be a feature. The L is no longer the surprise guest on Fully Vested because
I'm so sorry to hear that.
Because I moved.
And are you liking the new place? You getting comfortable?
Getting comfortable. You know, moving is always a slow motion. Well, happens all at once, but it's always a bit of a slow motion logistical nightmare, as yeah. I'm sure everybody is. Anybody who's moved, especially as you get older and you accumulate more stuff, you're like, man, moving is both highly inconvenient and very expensive once you like pay movers and stuff.
Yeah, moving is the worst. I really, really dislike moving personally.
Well, I think I got a COVID special on this place, and
that's a good deal.
I shudder to think what the rent is going to be after this lease is up, but that's going to be a problem for a later Jason, not a current Jason.
Yeah, many, many months out. The world could look totally different by then.
Well, I
hope positively, but...
Well, Graham, so this is the show. We should probably introduce ourselves.
Yeah, sure. So I'm Graham Peck. I am a venture partner at Midwest-based seed and Series A stage fund, Cultivation Capital. We are a St. Louis headquartered, also with an office in Chicago. And I am a member of our technology team. So we invest in seed and Series A stage B2B SaaS companies. We typically like to start working with them when they're around $500,000 to $1 million in ARR. In addition to that, I am a partner in a cybersecurity firm and a software development firm, and I also help companies large and small to build their development teams with remote resources, primarily with partners at Brightgrove, located in Ukraine and Belarus.
Sweet.
Jason, who are you?
Well, hey, everybody. My name is Jason Rowley. I'm one of your co-hosts here on Fully Vested. And when I'm not doing that at the day job, I am a researcher at Golden, which is a San Francisco-based startup, which is seeking to build the canonical source for knowledge. So, yeah, big mission. Graham, you and I have to talk about it at some point.
Yeah, that's like saying I'm going to go drink the ocean. Or climb Mount Everest or some like really lofty goal. I love it.
Well, I mean, climbing Mount Everest, everybody does that now.
Oh, yeah.
You just need to be willing to pay like 15 or 20 grand and to like wait in line for a long time. There's like so many. Have you seen these? That there are so many people who try to climb Mount Everest that there's like terrible traffic jams like near the summit.
I've seen the movie Everest, in which that's part of the problem that causes the death of a lot of people. I mean, in addition to a storm that kind of blows up basically out of nowhere, which I understand has a tendency to happen there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, On that cheerful note.
Yeah.
Graham, what you and I, we are going to be talking today about some good news. You know, in the past, yeah, we've done a couple of these episodes. But Graham, what are we doing here? What are we talking about today?
Yeah, so I'm super excited about this. You know, I mean, obviously, with everything that's going on in the world today, and you know, there's a lot of unrest. There's a lot of challenges that individuals, businesses, and you know, probably the worldwide economy will face. You know, given the pandemic, so we wanted to carve out some time to talk about good things that are going on, and because of the you know, venture and technology based kind of nature of our show, we wanted to start that by you know, not breaking the news on any of these, but talking about four companies tonight in particular that have recently within the last couple of weeks announced their capital raises. And so friend of the show, Ruben Flores Martinez at Cash Drop, also a Chicago company, so right in our backyard. Trove, Barn to Door, and Undock are the four companies that we're going to talk about tonight. And these were selected kind of just by us, again, as deals that we know of or saw or found interesting, and that we wanted to say shout out to them and give just a little bit more exposure, you know, to those cool companies that are, you know, doing something, at least in the case of Cash Drop, specifically to benefit other businesses that are struggling in these tough times. So
indeed,
that's what we're talking about tonight. And I'm super excited about it.
Yeah. No, me too. Me too. So, Graham, if you don't mind, I will lead off with Cash Drop.
Take it away.
Okay. So, Dateline, Chicago, sometime earlier in August. I guess it's September 1st now. So sometime last month, Cash Drop, a Chicago-based contactless payments and mobile-first e-commerce platform company, founded by Mexican immigrant Ruben Flores Martinez, announced that it had raised $2.7 million in seed funding. Harlem Capital led the deal, which saw participation from Founder Collective, Long Journey Ventures, and M25. Individual investors in the round include Cyan Bannister, who's now a partner at Long Journey Ventures after leaving Founders Fund, Adobe Chief Product Officer Scott Belsky, Fullscreen founder George Strombolis, and YouTube pioneer Michelle Phan. I'm going to get into a little bit of the other details about what the company is in a second, but I feel an obligation to disclose that I, your dear and long-suffering co-host, Jason Rowley, was a paid consultant and an advisor to the company during the process of formulating its documentation around its around announcing its seed round. And I helped out with some of the press outreach and stuff like that. And I wrote / edited the press release for it. So yes, in many ways, Graham and dear listeners, I'm acting as a bit of a paid shill here. But Cash Drop is not paying me to talk about what they're working on the podcast. And what they're working on is actually pretty cool.
Well, while we're doing disclosures, I'll also jump in and, you know, as our show notes that you so nicely wrote say, I also have a financial interest through one of the associated funds in Cash Drop. So maybe that makes the score even because I paid in, you know, to Cash Drop. So in any case, also not being compensated by them in any way unless they have a huge exit.
Indirectly, some of your dollars became my dollars.
Yeah, we could do some math and figure out how that works.
How that all melts down.
It's probably like, you know, a penny by the end of it.
Sure.
Anyway, or maybe way less, but you're welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Graham. I genuinely appreciate the what can one buy for like 10 cents these days?
I'm pretty sure that would be nearly nothing.
You could buy like a piece of like a bazooka bubblegum or something like that at one of those like old timey candy stores, I guess.
Yep, that's probably about right.
Okay, well, so thank you so much for the.
So what is the so what is a Chicago based startup Cash Drop doing?
Okay, so Cash Drop, their whole idea of Cash Drop is they wanted to build this mobile first platform that allows people with something to sell. And so that is a good or a service to give these people the ability to spin up a e-commerce shop to sell their wares or their services in like 15 minutes, which in itself would be pretty freaking neat. But what I think is even more interesting and what is sort of the company's primary differentiator, and this is how we sort of tie back into how the company is benefiting other businesses during this COVID-19 pandemic that we're all living through right now, is the economic model of the company. So, Graham, you are probably well aware of the fact that organizations like Chicago's own Grubhub and Uber Eats and DoorDash and all the rest, like, they will charge a pretty significant take rate from restaurants based on online orders or delivery orders that consumers place through those services, right?
Yeah, I am aware of that. And that's, you know, maybe I guess that's fine. And I assume those small businesses are, you know, kind of baking that into their pricing. Although, you know, what I think is unique and really great about Cash Drop, of course, is that they're charging only a 5% convenience fee to the customer and, you know, kind of pushing all of that off to the customer and allowing the business to kind of keep its normal prices and have its normal margin that it would otherwise expect. So yeah, I think that it's really great what they're doing. And yes, I was aware that those other businesses have a really high kind of aggregated, usually broken down into two or three different fee categories, kind of cost structure for those businesses.
Yeah. And so, you know, although Cash Drop has the sort of vision of being an incredibly flexible platform that can be really used by anybody with anything to sell, good, you know, good or service or whatever, and that, you know, the company is building in functionality that will allow for, I don't know, like, you know, being able to book time on a calendar, which could be great for, you know, in slightly different times, people booking, I don't know, haircuts, makeup appointments, whatever, whatever, that sort of stuff. You know, they've really seen, at least in the past few months, their largest source of new business has been restaurants that are switching to Cash Drop to facilitate all those payments online. Because again, these, you know, small businesses are going to be able to just keep much more of, keep all of what the customer pays them. And, you know, that will result in better economics for the business. And personally, my own, you know, unvarnished opinion here, also benefits the customer because, you know, you don't have to look at, I'm not going to name any particular names here, but, you know, through one of these competing food ordering apps, you know, you might open up stuff from, this actually happened to me 2 days ago, right? Like looking at a sushi restaurant and saying, man, I really like, you know, I could really go for like a salmon and avocado roll, and then looking at it and saying, what the hell are they charging $12 for this for? You know, it's like, it's $8 in the restaurant.
Yeah.
And
so maybe they have done exactly that. They've upped their prices, not including the delivery surcharges and the other things, because, I mean, the other services aren't shy about charging delivery fees, which are on top of what the restaurant's, you know, cut is as well. So the other, you know, businesses out there are charging customers, the end receiver of the food, direct delivery fees as well, I think.
Yeah.
And then still making it seem incumbent that you give a tip to your driver.
Yep.
But which I, you know, I generally do, because I figure anybody who's delivering food like that probably needs that tip more than I do.
Yep.
Fortunately.
Yep. But, you know, like that's that anyway. So I think that you know, Cash Drop is a really interesting business, and you know, its economic model is potentially quite disruptive to a lot of the again, you know, the online food ordering and other parts of the sort of like e-commerce stack. And you know, Ruben is a really compelling founder, and he's managed to raise from what I think is probably one of the most stacked benches of investors that a, you know, Chicago-based company's seed round has seen in years, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that that's right. I mean, you know, I consider myself lucky to consider, you know, Ruben and, you know, other members or advisors of the Cash Drop team friends. But yeah, you know, I have heard it described by other venture capitalists that this is like the, at least this year, but as you point out, probably for many years, this is kind of like the preeminent, you know, seed round in Chicago. Yeah. So I was really, you know, I mean, we've, while both really loving and trying to support the home team in Chicago, I think we've kind of dogged the, you know, environment at times on this show. And this, in my opinion, is a huge standout. And I'm really glad, I mean, number one, that it was a friend who was able to do this, but maybe even more importantly, or number two, is I'm really glad to see a Chicago-based company raising from this caliber of coastal investors, honestly.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it also just sort of shows that, you know, the sort of like lack of representation from many Chicago-based firms that we would typically associate with like investing in seed stage deals is really striking here. I think it just shows that that Cash Drop was successful in creating a sufficient FOMO around its offering that it was able to just close a bunch of commitments really, really quickly and at a speed that certain firms, you know, in Chicago just, you know, weren't able to match.
Yeah, you know, and I wonder if, and this is something that I've had a lot of discussions about, although that I don't know that we've ever discussed on the show, and we probably should. You know, we obviously are big advocates for the Midwestern-based investing ecosystem, not necessarily against the coasts, just advocates for our kind of local geography, I think. But I wonder if one of the other things is that that Midwestern investors are looking for a little bit more traction than probably a Cash Drop or a similar, more change the world or visionary kind of business like this has, and that coastal investors invest all the time in businesses that become really big and go somewhere really far, but they do so and take more risk often on something at an earlier stage. That probably goes hand in hand with the speed that you just mentioned. But I wonder if there's also a, this business's mentality is a little bit more, at least West Coast, in some ways than many others that are more Midwestern based businesses.
Yeah.
Which, and again, I think that's a double-edged sword, right? I mean, as a somebody who described themselves as a pragmatic Midwestern investor who works for a pragmatic, you know, fund, you know, I mean, I took a pitch pretty early on, and I of course want to support my friend or friends, and you know, love anything that Ruben's doing, having seen a couple of his prior businesses, but actually even talked for a short while about co-founding something with him and another friend. But all of that being said, I knew that based on kind of traction, even though it could grow very, very quickly, Cash Drop was unfortunately just too early for me to take to our partners and get any substantial support for a business, especially in these economic kind of climates, even though he's seeing such success in exactly some of the businesses as his end customers who struggle the most right now. So,
yeah, I mean, that's the thing that was sort of a little puzzling to me, because it's like, you know, I don't have all the exact numbers, and it's not really my place. Even if I did, it would definitely not be my place to share them here in this particular context, you know, whatever. But like, I mean, the company was, you know, it is generating revenue today, and it was generating revenue, you know, when it hit the fundraising trail, you know, earlier in the summer. So it's just kind of hard for me to see why there weren't more, why there wasn't more participation from Chicago-based firms here. And I think a lot of that just has to do probably with ability to move quickly and also just like based on the amount of capital that the company was trying to raise. It's not like they were trying to close $500,000. Like, you'd probably have a whole bunch of people line up for that. But, you know, they did close over $2.5 million, you know, 2.7. So, you know, they needed probably somebody with a slightly bigger pocket than what many Chicago-based firms are able and willing to put forth for, like, you, to your point, such an early stage company, but one that shows ridiculous promise.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, like, Cash Drop seems really interesting. I was super, super happy. There'll be a lot of links in the show notes. Got a long shout out, or long quote rather, a lot of column inches in an article by Aaron Griffith for the New York Times. Got covered by Crunchbase News, which is where I formerly used to work. And we got some attention from Biz Journals, built in Chicago, and a few other places. So I feel pretty good about how that funding round announcement rolled out. And best of luck to Ruben and the rest of the Cash Drop team going forward. So, Graham, do you want to talk about, moving on, do you want to talk a little bit about what is perhaps the most hotly anticipated company from, or at least hotly anticipated publicly disclosed company on the record? Sure. Company from the most recent Y Combinator batch?
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll read a little bit from our notes, which again will be available after the show, of course. So we're talking about Trove and their recently announced $16 million Series A. So on August 25th, Bay Area-based startup Trove announced that it raised $16 million in a Series A round, with media reporting that it raised at a $75 million post-money valuation. That was led by Andreessen Horowitz. And the company was, as Jason just mentioned, part of Y Combinator's recently graduated S20 batch, and they had successfully raised that round pre-demo day. So Trove is in the business of helping startups communicate the potential value of equity, usually offered in the form of options or maybe warrants, as some sort of a employee compensation or benefits package. You know, that helps both recruit and retain existing employees. And, you know, being in the venture space, I mean, we look very closely with all of our companies at, you know, helping them with the strategy of, and we bake into our round valuations refreshes of those options pools. So it is definitely something that, as a venture investor, we're looking at, you know, quarterly at least, with probably almost, if not every single one of our companies. So that gives employees greater transparency into the current, and then obviously from that potential or projected value of the shares that they're issued in the business, while also helping the employers allocate equity more wisely. And I know, you know, we've seen issues where an early employee was simply given ownership stake rather than being vested in through an options plan.
Oh, wow.
That has caused startup founders that I know to have, you know, substantial issues, and sometimes for them to have lower equity stakes than they maybe should or than they want, you know. And I guess on face value, as a venture investor, you might say, well, you know, you guys made this, you made this deal in the cold light of day, and you knew what you were doing. You know, you kind of got to live with it. But I guess the other line that you have to toe is that you always want your entrepreneurs and your founding team, and even the later employees, but you want your entrepreneurs and founding team to be and remain highly motivated by the potential success of that startup.
Totally.
So that's something that I think you have to be careful about and really pay a lot of attention to. So that's why I think that this is so important. And so Trove grants access on an anonymized basis to market performance data, and that also allows employers to understand what other industry participants are offering, maybe current and certainly prospective employees. So in terms of keeping your employment offers competitive to incoming potential candidates from a stock option perspective, you're able to do that as well. So definitely an interesting one to watch for sure.
Indeed. Yeah, I mean, again, this is one of the most hotly anticipated companies from the Y Combinator summer 2020 batch. They successfully had raised $850,000 in pre-seed funding back in March. And, you know, with this, oh my God, $16 million.
That's a chunk of change.
It's a bunch of money to raise at a Series A round. At a pretty hefty valuation. So, you know, obviously they have a lot to grow into, but, you know,
but they're going to have plenty of capital for a long time.
They're going to have,
I would hope,
plenty of runway. And then also, you know, considering how many people are sort of churning through out of various roles, due to, COVID-19 layoffs, there will be, plenty of people who take new jobs at new startups. And presumably, those folks will want some additional transparency into the total compensation package that they receive, and I think Trove will probably want to be the first in line to tell them about it. So I think that there's probably a lot of latent demand for the service, and Trove seems pretty well positioned to succeed. So it's their ball to drop now, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Do you think that there are businesses that may not want this level of, transparency or knowledge in these people's hands, right? You know, I mean, I guess I always think of options and warrants as kind of, you know, funny money, and you know, it may or may not turn into something. And of course, we've all seen it turn into very real amounts of money. But, you know, I've also heard employees often don't think about, including founders even, don't think about what the value of their equity is. But then when you quantify that in a real number, similar to the way you can quantify your bank account balance by looking at your online banking, it makes it more real for people. So I guess my question, or multiple questions may be buried in there, but are there any downsides of having this information kind of quote unquote in the wild, even though, you know, only anonymized data is released with any public sense, even though this is mostly just going to employees, is this make them think better, worse, different? I guess I could play several negative scenarios where, as an employer, even though this is pitched as a good thing to me, I might not want this data in, you know, the employee in all of my employees, who many of whom are probably not all that financially sophisticated, to kind of be aware of this, even though it all applies to them in this way.
So, Graham, to your point, there's a lot of different questions in that statement. And so let's unpack a few of them. So, like, first off, as you know, and as probably many of the people listening to this show know, as a general rule of thumb, it's always good to especially if you've joined like a seed stage startup or even a Series A stage startup, you know, that hasn't yet either hit, you know, product market fit or hasn't yet figured out a repeatable way to grow a business, right? Where you can say, for every dollar we invest in sales and marketing, we're going to get $1.50 out in revenue or whatever, right? That in those sorts of cases, when a company is really, you know, early on in its life cycle, as a general rule, it's advisable. And again, Graham and I are not financial advisors or whatever. This is general conventional wisdom, is to basically just round the value of those shares down to zero, right? Because, you know, at that point, you're treating that equity as a little bit of a lottery ticket that, again, if they're issued as options, you have the option to buy the ticket later on. But because, again, with really early stage companies, anything can happen. Another reason why I think this might be bad or potentially disadvantageous for a business to provide to its employees is, you know, sometimes there are businesses that have like really weird cap tables, right? So like they could have been spun out from a business, they could have been acquired and
then yeah, or maybe some sort of a joint venture between a couple of other big participants.
Right, exactly. And so in those sorts of cases, like you might not want to be as transparent about that, you know, sort of information because it could reveal certain information about how a broader deal came together, right? How a partnership formed or how everything shook out when a company was spun out from another company or whatever. And in those cases, you know, you might say to like telling an employee, like, hey, we issued you 20,000 shares in this company, but you know, what we're not telling you is that we have, you know, 75 million shares outstanding or whatever, using wholly made up numbers here. And, you know, having to communicate like, hey, the bunch of equity that you thought you had is actually not worth all that much as a function of the total percentage of the company. But you know, I think that there's in general more reasons to be transparent than not, because like the most talented people, which companies want to hire and retain, are going to go to the places that are most financially generous to them. And B, as part of that financial generosity will involve some amount of transparency around, not just the cash side or the, health insurance or whatever else, but the equity side as well. What's definitely, sorry, Graham, one last point here.
No, go ahead.
Is that like, you know, where this becomes really important is when you start sort of getting into like Series B, Series C, Series D and later stage companies, you know, where, especially companies that are sort of potentially on an IPO trajectory, you know, like in that case, those employees are very much counting their stock compensation as part of their total compensation package. Even if they are unlikely to see liquidity for that stock issuance in the like immediate short term, right? It's not like, oh, I work for a big public company and as part of my, you know, compensation package, I get X shares of stock that I can sell after a certain, you know, period of time into an open market. That's obviously not what happens to start with privately held companies, but,
No, I mean, I think you're right, you know, and to the extent that, you know, an employee has a substantial number of them and, you know, often these are done at discounts. But I would say as you get to some of those later letter rounds like B or above, and even occasionally at Series A, especially if you're a founder or very early at a company, but as you get to that B through, you know, later rounds, there's also the option for people to take some of that in a secondary if they actually have stock stock in the company.
Oh, yeah.
And so they may want to exercise some of those options. And as new investors are looking to acquire a bigger bite of the company, they might make an offer, where you get some of your cash out in the form of, a payment one time.
Right.
Sorry. Maybe not as clear as it should have been. But yeah, you get some cash immediately. You get some liquid cash immediately. And you probably give up additional upside, but you've obviously also taken some risk off the table. And there may occasionally be beneficial tax consequences of that too. Also, I think a lot of people end up exercising their options as their company's about to IPO and then getting a loan against those so that they can, exercise kind of bonus options that are often given to them around an IPO event, even though a lot of those things are also locked up. So,
and then also
necessarily as relevant here, but.
Well, don't forget to, take out the loan to pay the taxes on all that too.
Oh, well, right. Yeah.
My God.
Yeah. Maybe Trove will come up with a secondary lending platform that can tie into this when that happens.
You know what? Hey, look.
There's all these types of ancillary services that can be started around it.
Weirder things have happened, right? Like Carta is now in the business of fund administration and has its own secondary market. So like
there you go.
Carta is a whole like soup to nuts solution to this sort of thing. So
yeah.
Hmm.
Well, anyway, good luck to Trove. And, a question that I should certainly, as I sit here, know the answer to, although I didn't attend it, so I don't. How many companies went through Y Combinator's S20 batch?
I can actually tell you. There were 100.
Certainly something where we've seen that number steadily growing, and we've actually talked about that in one of the prior cohorts.
Yeah. So I want to get you a precise number. I want to say it was close to 200 companies. So there were.
Wow.
Yeah, it was bananas. So there were, let's see, what were there? There were like. There was like 190 some odd companies that were on the record. And then there were five companies which were off the record. And I know which companies those are, and they're all really cool. But I can't say anymore because it's off the record.
Oh, wow. Did you watch?
I did not, but...
Got it.
But between coverage and TechCrunch and then information that... my employer was able to receive to get its, to get the YC batch put together, which actually I should probably put in the, I got an open query link to that, which I should put in the show notes. We show all of the companies that had pitched on the record. And there are a lot of really neat ones besides Trove that did pitch on the record. So Human Loop, I found really interesting. They're a sort of natural language processing annotations company. Let's see what else. There's a LSK Technologies, bit of a weird name, but they're developing a sort of like laboratory in a box for doing like diagnostics tests. Another one that I found really neat was Gilgamesh Pharmaceuticals, which is developing what they're sort of referring to as quote unquote like a better ketamine. So for like psychedelic therapy applications, the drug that they're specifically working with is called, aryl cyclohexamine. Oops, wait, aryl cyclohexolamine. There we go.
Wow, that's quite a name.
It's quite a name. But yeah, super interesting companies in this season's YC Summer 2020 batch. I will post a link in the show notes.
Awesome. And again, I know we've maybe picked out a handful of our favorites and covered them in the past. Maybe we'll have another episode like that coming up.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially, man, I just can't wait until there was, Graham, I'll mention it a little bit to you after we're done recording. One of the off the record ones.
All right. I can't wait to hear it.
Yeah. So anyways, man. Let's see.
You want to tell us more about Barn to Door?
Barn to Door. Okay, so this was a fun one. That I actually had originally I found it via via an SEC filing, and it turned out that it ended up getting a little bit of coverage in the press. So on August 26th, Seattle area online marketplace startup Barn to Door raised $6 million in a new round of funding, which was led by Bullpen Capital. Participating investors in the deal include Sugar Mountain, Rain Ventures, Quiet Capital, Lead Edge Capital, and Global Founders Capital. Crunchbase lists its round as a Series A, although the round type was not named explicitly in media coverage of the transaction. Barn to Door had raised $3.4 million for the first tranche of its Series A back in 2019, and that particular round was led by Lead Edge Capital out of New York. According to Golden, the company has raised nearly $12.5 million across its publicly disclosed funding rounds. And Graham, the reason why I thought the Barn to Door was cool is because, as I previously, you know, discussed, they are building a platform that connects people who run farms that like grow vegetables, raise animals, make
dairy,
milk. Yeah, sure.
Eggs,
they're dairy companies, butter. all the above. Giving them a way to directly connect to consumers who want to buy the vegetables, eat the beef, get the eggs, stuff like that. And what I found particularly neat about its platform is that it's able to accommodate farms with many different types of business and service models, including everything ranging from like on the farm, like local pickup, to like delivery, to even like shipping and doing stuff with like subscription boxes and stuff like that. So I found it to be really neat. I think that as people spend a lot more time at home and cooking at home and simultaneously becoming more mindful of the food that they eat and the consequences of raising that food in the ways that food is raised at an industrial scale today, you know, I think that there might be something there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's really cool. You know, it's interesting to think about like what the food supply chain is and how complex it is. And so if I'm going to eat a vegetable or a steak, then it's interesting to think about what the life cycle of that has been from live animal or in the ground vegetable until it's, you know, in my hands, at my supermarket, or on my plate.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy when you really think about it, right?
It really is. And it's really complex. And, you know, as you point out, you know, and without grinding any kind of political axe here, it's really bad for the planet. Like, really bad for the planet.
Yeah.
Like, and I, you know, whatever you believe about, you know, climate change, I think the single worst thing we do for the planet is produce food in the way we produce food.
Yep.
You know, I've seen some studies that connect as much as 51%, so over half of all CO2 emissions are related in some way to food production.
I can believe it.
Yeah, I mean, and so like that's half. Holy cow.
Yeah.
Over half.
Yeah. Anyway. So, you know, like this sort of like direct from farm to consumer thing is really neat for other reasons, too. It's not just the ability to support, you know, farmers that have good sound agricultural practices. It also helps, you know, breaking news, Graham, farming is not necessarily known as a particularly lucrative business. So anything that allows farmers to keep a larger margin of whatever revenue that they had as their profit is no doubt really good for farmers too.
Yeah. You know, and I used to know the statistic off the top of my head, and unfortunately it escapes me, but how far the average piece of food has traveled before it lands on your plate. And the number I think would shock you, you know, distance in miles, and it's something like 1600, but I could be wrong and that might be too high, but it's definitely very high, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, and again, I'm not trying to, you know, grind any kind of political axe. I've been pretty dramatically reducing my meat intake as of late, meat and dairy. But, you know, for every pound of meat you consume, that also represents some very large number of bushels of corn and hundreds or maybe thousands of gallons of water to produce
per pound.
One pound of meat because of the way it's produced.
Yep. Yeah. Anyway. So, I mean, to that end though, like bringing it back to a little bit of the YC batch, you know, there's some really interesting stuff around, plant derived and cellular, you know, agriculture, which I think could be really neat in the future. So there was like one company from this year's YC batch that, using, an array of plant-based proteins, have engineered apparently a pretty tasty substitute for raw tuna.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I would love to try that.
Me too, at some point. Whenever it becomes widely available, I am going to be first in line for that.
Because, you know, I have to say, I had my first Beyond Burger maybe 2 weeks ago approximately. And, you know, while I guess I've got some questions around the processing of that and whether that's actually any healthier for you and I guess maybe even if it's any better for the planet, I have to say it was pretty darn good.
Beyond or Impossible?
I believe I had a Beyond where I was. I don't think I have tried the Impossible. And I have had, because I was, you know, fully vegan or plant-based, whatever you want to call it. I was doing it for my own health reasons. And again, I'm pretty close to that again right now. But I was fully plant-based for nearly a year, several years ago. So I tried nearly every kind of, you know, black bean or veggie-based burger on the market then. And while I got to the point where I liked them, and believe me, I had that for like 3 or 4 meals last week, so it's still a staple in my diet, like a quinoa burger or a black bean burger or something like that, when I'm eating this way, none of them are nearly as good tasting as the Beyond that I've had.
Yeah.
And not a sponsor, not an ad for them. It was just, I was very impressed that they made plants taste that way.
Although, folks over at Beyond Meat and Impossible and Impossible Foods, will gladly take your money.
That's right.
Mm.
And I would love to try a plant, especially if it's actually healthy for you. I'd love to try a plant that tastes like tuna. That'd be interesting.
Mm. Indeed, indeed. So yeah, anyways, I thought that that this was just like really interesting, just again, for a bunch of reasons, you know, people just paying more attention to what they're eating, how they're eating, what that does to both their bodies and to the planet. You know, I think, Barn Door is, it's onto something.
You know, and I think that, and we've talked about this a little bit before, I think maybe in one of our follow-on episodes, but I think the D2C consumer, you know, kind of consumer trend is really going to grow. I mean, obviously, it's been growing a ton, and the venture community has certainly latched on to, you know, direct-to-consumer as like an investable space and thesis. There are people, not me or our team, but there are definitely people who understand, you know, B2C or D2C, whatever you want to call it, and understand how to grow those businesses in a very impressive way. So it'd be interesting to see if this is one of the ones that takes off.
Well,
I'm a big believer in that trend overall, even though that's not one of the specific waves that my team is riding.
Yeah. And I mean, and as we've seen with, you know, with the like absolutely meteoric rise of Shopify, especially over the last, you know, 6 to 12 months. It just really shows that when there is a shift toward the more direct-to-consumer consumption model, the marketplace platforms that mediate those transactions and those direct-to-consumer relationships end up benefiting quite substantially. So I would not be surprised if in their pitch deck, Barn to Door basically said, hey, we're Shopify for farmers.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I had a discussion with one of my business partners today about just being tangential to other spaces. And, you know, one of the things that we were talking about was, you know, using a gold rush analogy, like, hey, let's not go pan for gold, but let's absolutely open up the best, you know, shovel and pickaxe store that we can right next to, you know, the river.
Oh, so. Hey, I mean, Levi Strauss,
hey, there you go. Yeah.
They built a fabulous pants company selling trousers to gold miners. So
there you go.
So, Graham, do we want to transition into our final subtopic and talk a little bit about Undock?
Yeah, absolutely.
You have you have most of the context here. So take it away.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Also friends of the show, although no connection as specific as with Cash Drop, so nothing specific to disclose here. But Undock is a software platform that lets people instantly schedule, host, and document meetings. Their AI-powered calendar solution helps connect people across teams, time zones, and different organizations. And I will say, as a personal user of this, and if anybody wants to schedule time with me, I can, you know, use Undock as a very, very easy way, you know, to facilitate that. I am a big fan of this product, and I have seen the amount of back and forth in emails when a meeting is to be scheduled, but just around the meeting logistics go down dramatically. And I love that because that's not value added time. So, you know, I mean, things like Superhuman, which we've talked about before on the show, and Calendly are, you know, tools that are trying to help people save time in related kinds of ways. I think Undock is the best way. And doesn't do the same thing as Superhuman, by the way, and probably a much closer competitor of Calendly, but just makes the scheduling experience absolutely phenomenal from start to finish, in my opinion. So they recently raised a round of $1.4 million from Lightship Capital, Bessemer Venture Partners, Alumni Venture Group, Active Capital, Arlen Hamilton, Sarah Imbach, and other angels. They had previously raised and gone through the ERA accelerator in January. ERA had invested $100,000. The team is currently about 10 people, based headquartered in New York, and also with I think their development happening out of Ukraine, but not the team that I work with. So yeah, I mean, I just think, again, they're friends of the show. They participate actively in kind of a little happy hour series that I co-host called Funders and Founders. But in any case, just really like this company. I'm really excited to see, you know, as people are going to so many more, often back-to-back-to-back meetings all day long, love the idea of seeing all of the complexities around scheduling logistics just going nearly to zero, right?
Yeah, for sure.
The main user flow here is that once you, and it takes a little bit of time, but, you know, sub 1 hour, you tie all of your calendars in and you give Undock your preferences. Then when you're typing an email, if you say something like, Jason, would you like to meet? You simply hit the slash key and then you're able to see times that are free in your calendar, and it will tell you which ones of those based on your preferences and past kind of choices are the most likely candidates for us to want to connect. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that I also use Undock, it'll automatically take my availability or it'll automatically mix in my availability if you're emailing me. And if two or three other people are CC'd on that email, it will you know, copy them on the calendar invite as well when it gets sent. So then I send you that email with, hey, Jason, you want to meet at any one of these three times? And I've selected three times that work well for me based on my calendar, even if I don't know anything about your availability. And those are automatically links. And if in your email box when you receive it, by the way, for all of our listeners out there, Jason never checks his email box, but that's a separate.
That's a lie. That's a lie. That's
Jason
that's
almost slander. Never checks that's, his email, that's, okay. email box. But all of that being said, those links then are clickable. And if you click that link, that is automatically on both of our calendars and anyone else CC'd or included in the to field on that email with calendaring logistics, like how to dial in, where we're meeting. All of that is all automatically done seamlessly through one click.
That is super clever. You know, I've seen
brilliant.
I have seen a couple of companies in, you know, like really early stage companies in this sort of calendaring, like smart calendaring space. I've never tried Undoc, but that interaction model seems really, really nice.
It's so slick. And again, after a relatively short setup period, it's easier to send an email. You don't have to flip back and forth, which even with the three screens that I'm sitting in front of, I'm still usually flipping back and forth or putting things on different windows and looking for calendar availability. Just hit slash and I've got choices. I click a couple of them. Those are available to you. You do usually have to explain it because people aren't, other users aren't used to it. So I also put in a sentence explaining, hey, I use this new service called Undoc. If you want to try it, you can go to their website here and sign up for free. But also just click one of these links and we'll be ready to go when you choose a time. Anyway, again, it's just a brilliant, brilliant experience. Saves users on both ends tons of back and forth and complexity. Because then how many times do you have a meeting where we even agree on a time and no one sends out a calendar invite and you go back a couple of days later and realize, hey, we never actually had that meeting. Anyway, that's also happened to me a number of times. So,
oh, for sure.
I love to see these entrepreneurs challenging, kind of the status quo and the way that we do things. Just the old way in our lives today. And again, I think there's huge opportunity for this, whether COVID continues or not, but probably even more the longer COVID goes on because of the way a lot of busy professionals are stacking up their meetings every day.
Yeah, for sure.
It can also have, by the way, a preference setting that says, if I already have more than, and you can set the number of hours of meetings on my calendar for a day, don't schedule me anymore.
Ooh, that's nice.
Yeah. So if you like to have some executive time or whatever you want to call it, some time to yourself, or, you know, I don't want more than 4 hours of meetings in a day so that I can get work done on other action items that I've got, you can absolutely make that happen or not allow Undoc at least to schedule more time.
That's cool. Okay.
Similar to Calendly, you could also have a profile. So, you know, if I publish or send someone my link, they can go to my calendar and choose any time that works for them. That's also an available feature, although that's not the primary way I've engaged with their product to date.
Yeah. So also
very responsive team, I would say, just as a personal shout out. I had a couple of technology challenges and one of their founding team members got on and walked me through with the screen share exactly how to fix the issue I was having. So appreciate
great.
Early personal attention.
Awesome. So how do you think, throwing you a little bit of a curveball here, do you think that, how do you think they would do in the longer run if, say, a service like Superhuman rolled out a calendaring feature, as is rumored about Superhuman in particular?
Well, and I think Superhuman may already have some similar functionality, even though I said they weren't a competitor. I mean, their whole goal, I think, is to streamline the emailing process holistically, including calendar logistics. But I don't think only that. I think that Anytime you're deeply integrated to someone's email, or maybe even like, hey, could do this as well, which is, you know, another thing that we've talked about on the show, although not any of their specific functionality. But in any case, you know, if you've actually got someone's whole email box, I definitely think that it's a lot more powerful and you can do a lot more with that information. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and this is definitely one of those businesses, like so many are, that a Google, maybe an Apple, but definitely a Google could absolutely add functionality that did all of this that they haven't. And you never know. I mean, you know, Gmail and its associated calendar or Office 365 could roll out a new version tomorrow that has all of what Undock does. My gut instinct is that's unlikely, but yeah, I mean, I think that that's definitely an unavoidable risk in space. Because it seems like a small annoyance, but it's a small annoyance and inconvenience that everyone has.
Yeah.
So there's a huge addressable market here.
I mean, also probably on pricing, you know, they're much more competitive just because, you know, Superhuman is $30 a month, which I still can't get over.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to be Superhuman for $30 a month, but I had in mind like flying or seeing through walls or something. I don't know. Mm. I mean, for the moment, at least, while I'm sure there's a business model behind it, and that's actually not something that I've talked with the team about at all, but Undock is free.
For now. For some people, yeah, well, it's free for everybody for now, but yeah, who knows what the future might bring, but definitely interesting.
Beta, so it's free for everyone who's using it, and or I think you can sign up now, looks like.
Graham, I just wanted to, before we wrap this up, I just wanted to issue a very minor correction to what you said earlier, which is Undock raised 1 point, it's reported at least by Lightship Capital that Undock had raised 1.6 million, not 1.4 million. In its,
oh, gotcha. Well, the 1.4 that I reported came directly from one of the founding team members. So that was my source on the information. And it even says that he'll update me if that number goes up. He did not do so before the recording of this show. unless I've missed his email, which is totally possible. So apologies to the Undock team and congratulations for the extra $200,000.
Indeed. I guess
thanks for the catch there, co-host.
Quite, they're now massively oversubscribed.
Ah, well, there you go.
Anyways, Graham, I think that this was a good one. Definitely a lot of really interesting companies out there, super exciting stuff that's happening, despite the fact that the larger macro economy and you know, global geopolitical order slowly collapse around all of us in slow and ever increasing motion. Still a bunch of really interesting entrepreneurs working on a bunch of really interesting problems and have managed to be successful in raising money to solve those problems. So definitely interesting stuff.
Keep up the good work out there, everybody. I mean, I know it's I know it's tough times, and definitely want to see small businesses continue to succeed, because I think that, you know, small businesses are going to have huge opportunities as we, you know, continue to move through the COVID pandemic, you know, and as we talked about, I think on a prior episode, you know, there was a great cohort of companies like Uber and Airbnb and others that came out of the 2008, you know, kind of economic situation. And so this being a deeper and sharper decline, at least on the front side of it, you know, we're hopeful that there are great new opportunities and a great new cohort of small businesses, soon to be big businesses that become household names in the technology and venture capital spaces and outside, that see new success because of this. So keep up the good work, everybody.